control your own emotions.
Yeah. How come I heard this today?
Messages from the governor and or the House. We don't have any messages from the governor. Do we? We'll send messages to him.
From the House of Representatives, January the 19th, 2015. Message number 103, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House bill number 16, offenses against public administration. Ayes 59, noes 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. From the House of Representatives, January the 19th, 2015. Mr. President, the following bills passed on third reading. The bill listed below passed on the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill number 14, Electronic Citations, ayes 57, noes 3. Message number 100, third reading passed amended. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 3, Department of Insurance Fine Schedules, ayes 42, noes 18. Message number 101, third reading passed amended. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 13, State Parks Use of Fees, ayes 58, noes 2. Message number 104, third reading, passed amended. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 17, Sexual Assault Protection Orders, ayes 58, noes 2. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. From the House of Representatives, January 19, 2015, message number 5. Mr. President, this is an informing that the House has adopted House rules of the 62nd Wyoming State Legislature as the rules of the 63rd Wyoming State Legislature with the following amendments. And I'm not going to take time to read them. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Introduction, reading, and reference of bills. Senate File 84, first reading.
Senate File 84, Enhanced Recovery Carbon Dioxide Certification, sponsored by Senator Von Flader.
Senate File 84 is assigned to Committee Number 9, Minerals. Senate File 79, first reading.
Senate File 79, Title of Chiropractors, sponsored by Senator Geis.
Senate File 79 is assigned to Committee Number 10, Health. Senate File 85, first reading.
Senate File 85, Adult Foster Care Pilot Project, sponsored by Senator Scott.
Senate File 85 is assigned to Committee Number 10, Health. Senate File 86, first reading.
Senate File 86, Massage Therapist Licensing, sponsored by Senator Peterson.
Senate File number 10 is also assigned to, or Senate File 86 is assigned to Committee Number 10, Labor. Reports from Standing Committee.
January the 19th, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 9, Right to Farm, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Christensen, Esquivel, Hicks, Kinsey, Key, and Von Fladeren, Senator Christensen, Chairman. January the 19th, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 57, School Facilities Appropriations, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Anderson, O2, Coe, Dockstader, Pappas, and Rothfuss, Senator Co-Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that takes us back to...
Yeah, Mr. President.
Hold on. Was there something you had before, or you wanted to... Announcements, Senator Coe.
Mr. President, Senate File 57 was just ready. That's school CapCon appropriations. I'd ask that it be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations.
Thank you. Senate File 57, without objection, is re-referred to Appropriations. I think that takes us... No further announcements, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. That takes us back to Committee of the Whole.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that Committee of the Whole, we resolve ourselves back into the Committee of the Whole to discuss bills on general file.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion has been adopted. Senator Amrick.
Committee of the Whole will come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 5. Reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 5, Quebec Number 1 Historic Site, sponsored by the Travel Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Anderson, 28, Barnard, Cooper, Kraft, and Johnson, Senator Cooper, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senator Burns, Hastert, Ross, No, Senator Wasserberger. Excuse, Senator Perkins. Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises and reports that do so with a recommendation that Senate File 5, Quebec 1, Historic Site 3, do pass. There is no standing committee amendments on this bill, and for an explanation of the bill, I'd like to yield the floor to the good Senator Queen Kraft.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. If you look in your inbox, you'll see a fact sheet on Senate File 5, which is the Quebec One Missile Alert Facility. And it really explains in really good detail the information that we received in the TRW committee. Under the START Treaty, the Air Force, the United States Air Force, has to dismantle its peacekeeper missile system. But they are allowed to keep one of the missile alert facilities available for historical purposes, educational purposes, interpretive purposes. So what the kind of the procedure here was, the Air Force asked Wyoming State Parks, Historic Sites and Trails, to evaluate the Quebec one and see if this would be appropriate as a state historical site for us. They have a really very, very significant vetting process. It went through the whole thing. I have the chain of everything it goes through to be vetted, the site criteria process, and it was approved unanimously by them. And there were a number of reasons why. And so I'd like to share just a few of them. They're on your sheet. But a few of the reasons why it received that unanimous approval from all kinds of different folks on that commission is that the MX, or the Peacekeeper, was most sophisticated missile system. It was credited by many scholars with the missile that won the Cold War. But this is why it's important for Wyoming. This is the only facility potentially of its kind in the entire world once the terms of the START Treaty are implemented. This is our story. This is a Wyoming story. Wyoming is where the Peacekeeper is centered. It's the only place in the world where it was deployed. So this is our history. This is our story. And we have the opportunity to have a very accessible, easily identified place for the traveling public. And one of the things that came out in the committee that was really new to me, because they were talking about, you know, for the baby boomers, this is history, and I am very definitely a baby boomer, so this is my history. And I remember those times. I remember the duck and cover drills. I remember sitting down in the bomb shelter. I remember all those things. But what I didn't know, I thought we just had our memories. I didn't understand that nuclear tourism is a huge industry. It's one of the fastest growing forms of tourism, I guess because baby boomers like me are getting really old and we want to travel around and see some of these places. So it's really an excellent opportunity for us not just to preserve our history, but to preserve a site that this is the only place in the world you will see it. Now, there's similar facilities in other areas, but no Peacekeeper. We did get some information on some of them just in terms of what do you recapture in terms of revenue if you do this? Because if indeed we did make this a state historic site, of course, an admission fee would be charged. So we found there's a Minuteman II facility in South Dakota, not even remotely as accessible as we are. The site for this is off I-25. It's at about milepost 39. You can see it. As you get off the exit, you can see the site right there. This facility is not accessible. It's a Minuteman II. They have 90,000 visitors a year. There's one in Arizona for the Titan. Again, not easily accessible. They have 50,000 visitors a year. So even if you don't look at the historical aspects, even if you don't look at the opportunity for Wyoming to have something that is unique, unique to us and the role we played, there's a great chance for us to increase some revenue through the tourism dollars that are there and available for us. One of the things that was interesting also was the department shared with us that they had a survey done in 2010 to kind of see exactly what the economic impact of Wyoming State Parks and historic sites is on our communities. And they found out something very interesting. They found that for every dollar of state funding that we spend on our sites, we get $8.97 returned to our communities. So to me, it seems like a way to preserve a very, very valuable piece of our history, a unique piece of our history, and actually bring some revenue to the state. And that's exactly what the bill does. It authorizes our Department of State Parks and Cultural Resources to accept the Quebec One Missile Alert Facility from the Air Force. It declares it a state historic site to be administered, operated, and maintained by the department. The fiscal note splits the appropriation up, $10,000 in fiscal year 15 for just startup costs, one-time startup costs to actually maintain the facility, $65,000 in fiscal year 16 for site improvements, and then in 2017 is when the $100,000 would be used to develop the interpretive plan, the interpretive signs, the exhibits. And, of course, those funds in 2019, all the unobligated and unexpended ones, revert back. So that's the bill in a nutshell. That's the history behind it. I would urge your favorable consideration, and I would stand for any questions. Thank you.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I've got, I guess, a lot of questions on this bill. So I would assume that currently the federal government has this piece of property and has an obligation to reclaim it fully. And if there are any environmental issues, they would take care of that. And I would assume that's a multi-million dollar obligation. And for the federal government to say, well, this is a great way for the federal government to get out of its reclamation obligations by turning property over to the state. So, first of all, we're being asked to take title to a piece of property. My question is, has there been a full environmental study so we know exactly what the cost to reclaim the property and address the property is, what's the environmental impact of the state of Wyoming's accepting the property? And then if one day is determined that the property should be fully reclaimed, is that now our obligation, and what's the cost of that obligation? I think those are questions I'd like to have asked answer first, if you could, please.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, kind of along those lines, one of the questions that comes to my mind, if this facility is already over 50 years old, it should be eligible under the National Historic Preservation Act. And I'm just wondering if there was any discussion that this site would be nominated as a historical site. Under that particular case, the military department then would be responsible for maintaining that as a historical site. So I'd like some discussion as to whether that was looked at as a possibility or not.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see how it's split up to begin with and started with, but I'm trying to track down what we would be, say we do take it over, what we would be spending each and every year to maintain, keep it open, keep it ready for the public.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'll try and answer some of these questions. I think anybody who has been down into the Missile Command Center has come back impressed. As far as the President's questions about reclamation of the property, that is going to be a requirement of any land transfer. It has to be reclaimed, and as a matter of fact, what we're talking about with the military right now is that they have many of the components from the interior, the seats and the fronts for all the panels and electronic panels and so forth already in. As far as environmental assessment and so forth, that would have to already be done as a condition before State Parks would take it over. The $165,000 is one-time money, and that's actually to for a little bit of landscaping, but mostly for the road and for the parking lot outside, and to rehab the building inside to make it functional, basically. There's no heat or anything like that. The Missile Command Center down below, the military would have to do all that. And as far as environmental assessment, as I said, they'd have to do that. But I don't know what the problem, if they would have a big problem doing that. This is not a missile silo. There were no fuels or anything stored there. This was the electronic command center that controlled 10 different silos around Wyoming. The question about federal government and this being designated historic site, the federal government actually runs the site in South Dakota, which was a Minuteman II missile command center. I happened to visit it this summer. It is about half the size of the MX command center we have here, and it's about half as deep. It is along I-90, but where the visitor center is, and they're building a visitor center, is about 3 miles from where the command center is, and the way they're doing it is in tours of about 10 or 12 people that they transport over there. And even with a kind of a clunky business model like that, they still brought in 80,000 people at about 10 bucks a person, and or 850 for groups and students and so forth. And I-90, and I looked for it, there is no highway signage. And not only that, the area of interstate where the command center itself has been under construction all this last summer, and they still had 80,000 people who went and visit this place. The one up here, up on exit 39, is actually, it's deeper and bigger and, frankly, much more impressive than the one the feds run over in South Dakota. But I don't think you could talk the federal government into opening this up and running it again. I think there would be a duplication of purpose. It would be a noble thing to try. The problem we have is we're time limited. We don't know exactly when this has to be done by, but it has to be done by a date certain to be transferred over for tourist purposes, for informational and educational purposes, or under the START Treaty, the terms of the START Treaty, it will be filled in with concrete. That's what they have to do regarding Russia. It would be the loss of a unique historical structure. And as far as it being 50 years old, it was actually it's closer to 30, 35 years old when the MX missiles were put in. They were only put in Wyoming, and they were given up during the START Treaty with Russia. It's something very unique to Wyoming. As to the question from the good senator from Star Valley about the ongoing expenses, this is something that's going to take the Air Force time to do. So we're not talking about having tourists going in there till about 2019. It's not clear whether we will keep a permanent full-staff employee there or if it'll be run as a satellite out of, say, the governor's mansion or some other site down here. But we do think there will be a lot of volunteer help from retired missileers who have retired to stay in Cheyenne. And we have, an endless supply of those here in Cheyenne. I think that's more likely to happen than needing a full-time employee there. And I hope that answers all the questions asked so far.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One thing to talk a little bit about the scenario as far as O&M on this facility. The proposition that was put forward to the Appropriations Committee, which is not a part of this bill, because it was recommended that they go through appropriation process for any type of funding for this, for personnel. But it was either one full-time, maybe three part-time, or only three part-time, and people would have it run out of the another office here in the city. But the fact of the matter is, when you consider even $5 to $10 a head for a fee charge to get through that facility, and if you get even half of the number of people that these other facilities have had, would more than pay for the O&M maintenance or O&M cost of the operation of this facility.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, if you go into the Historic Preservation Act, it designates under here that the administrator of that office at the state level has to develop and maintain a statewide preservation plan for all state historic sites. So I'm wondering, what's the fiscal note to the State Historic Preservation Office to be able to comply with the National Act if, in fact, we actually adopt this as a state historic site?
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think those are good explanations, but I'm still concerned if you look over on page 2 of the bill, under the definition or under the administration issue. So what we've done here is given a very broad authority to the state, to a state agency, to go out and hold title to administer and operate this property. And we're giving that authority without a legal description, so we don't know exactly what's going to be acquired. We're giving it that authority without seeing an environmental assessment, so we don't know what the liability is going to be, and we don't know what the closure requirement is going to be for the long term. Seems to me, and I guess part of the question is to the sponsors, is that if, in the event, this is an asset that can be used for a tourism facility, has the state explored the idea of leasing it from the federal government or engaging in a relationship where we don't take title, ultimate title resides with the federal government with either a use agreement or a lease agreement. So at the end of the day, as events change and it has to be filled with the concrete, the entity that created the liability is going to take care of the liability. But for the state now, without knowing what the environmental assessment is, what the closure obligations, what the total liability is, we now are proceeding to engage in what could be a very, very costly cleanup. We don't know this information. Historically, I think if you go back and look at these types of statutes where we authorize agencies to acquire land, before we could say, it's one thing to say, go out and explore this, go out and get an environmental assessment, come back with a plan. But rarely do we go sending out an agency and saying, you're permitted to acquire something without an EA, environmental assessment, without a budget, without any full understanding of what the liability side to this is. And I think with my colleague from the mother county originally was alluding to is that there are other mechanisms to explore where the federal government retains title to it so the state is simply operating it in a tourism fashion. And the beauty of that type of relationship, once again, is that we're not undertaking a liability at all. And what's not addressed in here is what are the scope of the liability, and in a few quick seconds, you're authorizing an agency to go out and determine and potentially acquire a significant liability that you don't even know what it is.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, these are all useful suggestions and the notes of caution and depth of debate I would expect from this body. And as to whether the property can be leased from the military department by the state, I don't know if that's feasible under the terms of the START Treaty. That's something that I hope that the floor manager will explore because there are a few other questions that she wants to have looked up to, such as the date and things like that. As far as an environmental assessment goes, I think that's a good idea, and I think that would be a friendly amendment to this bill, that an environmental assessment be included or required before the state would take possession of the land. And I think that would take care of a lot of the liability, or any other liability issues I think should be amended onto this bill. I think it's a good idea.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, great ideas that I've heard here that we need to do, that we need to explore. But I do rise to speak to the bill. I think that it's important for us to maintain this facility. It is, as was said, a historic site for Wyoming. I mean, we've only had one active duty mission here in Wyoming at this time, and that's the ICBM mission. And the Peacekeeper missile, by the way, was deployed in 1986 and was taken out of service in 2005. And I think that that legacy of the MX missile, of the Peacekeeper, needs to be preserved by the state of Wyoming and for sure the folks that have put all their time and their effort and have retired here, they would be able to come up with volunteers. I know I've spoken with the folks at the museum at F.E. Warren Air Force Base, and there are a lot of former missileers who have put time and effort into that museum that would indeed put a lot of time and manpower into a new historic state museum. I do agree that we need to get the historic preservation folks from the state involved into the process. But I do believe that it's an opportunity that we should not miss. That if we do miss it, it'll never come back again. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're getting off on tangents here. It's always good to check your liabilities, and this site probably has the fewest liabilities of any that we have. One thing we want to remember, all the money we're appropriating for is for operations. It is not for purchasing the property. The second bullet point on your fact sheet says USAF formally requested Wyoming State Parks evaluate the Quebec One MAF as a state historic site. Under the terms of the treaty, USAF is allowed to keep one missile alert facility for interpretive and educational purposes. I would submit to you that the USAF is keeping this facility. We are just turning it into a state historical site and operating it for them.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I keep in mind when I think about Quebec One that this is our history. It belongs to those of us that grew up in the Cold War. The day that Winston Churchill defined the Iron Curtain, until the walls went down in Germany and the countries were given their liberty in the 1990s on forward. That's ours. We're the nuclear generation. And I have something that's even rarer. I grew up in Las Vegas, and I can remember sitting in elementary and high school and looking out the window and seeing the surface nuclear blasts go off. I saw close to 100 of them, so it was no big deal. Would see a flash of light, look out, see the cloud, and about 15 minutes later, the whole building had rattled. But we just got used to it. So let's talk about Quebec One and what Quebec One is. You go north on I-25, I think 25 miles, and if you look over to your left, kind of behind a hill, you'll see it. It's a nondescript military-type building with a garage next to it and a big, huge fence. And the gripped military building was the headquarters. And a master sergeant, an E-7, was always in charge of that facility. Then they had their crew there. The crew mainly was one cook and then a whole lot of air police that went around going to all of the 10 missiles that command site controlled. And there were 10, and they were all about 10 miles out from the command post in a circle. No matter what the weather was, they had to go out there, and was not the prime duty in the U.S. Air Force, I'll tell you that. I went down in Quebec site. I went down in it when it was a MX site, and it was pretty incredible. We went down the elevator, although there is stairs. And the three things that I will always remember down there are the two chairs that the commander and his deputy commander were strapped into, and they were on rails, and the blast door. And I don't know how thick the blast door was, but it was probably, I'm 6'4", and it was probably thicker than I am high. Then, of course, there were electronics all over the place, but the electronics are electronics. So we had 200 missiles here. I mean, 200 missile command facilities here. Minuteman III, there's still 150 of them. Why are they Minuteman III? Three warheads each missile. An MX, a peacekeeper, the thing that got the Soviets hysterical about them was they had 10 warheads, and each one of them could be individually guided on those. So essentially, it's believed that the peacekeeper is the reason that the Russians folded. They could not afford to match it. They just couldn't, and they went under for financial reasons. 50 peacekeeper command sites. There's one left. One left. The others full of cement, concrete now, and smashed in. The missile sites themselves for the missiles, full of concrete and smashed in. That was agreed to, and we have already done that. This is our one chance to have something that's unique to our generations and unique to Wyoming. And that's the Peacekeeper command site. North Dakota and Montana have Minuteman threes. That's all they've ever had. Well, they probably had Minuteman ones at one time like we did. But now they're at Minuteman threes. The only place the peacekeepers ever went in, and I always thought that was so funny because it worked. They kept the peace. Is in Wyoming. So our archaeologists go out in the United States and spend a lot of time digging and searching and analyzing and making guesses. We won't need to do that on this. This will be set up for those who want to tour it, who want to see what happened. What was it like during the Cold War? The Cold War, our Cold War. We're all veterans of the Cold War. There are a lot of them, probably several amendments in here that can answer several questions and several concerns. But I think we ought to keep this alive and keep it going. It really is important.
Senator Cooper.
Just to hopefully wrap this up a little bit. Good president mentioned a number of things that I thought were appropriate, especially the possibility maybe of the lease situation. But I was thinking that in direct answer to one of his questions about whether this thing is environmentally safe or not, you know, I was thinking, and I'll promise to find this out and get back with you on it, but I believe that the federal government is responsible for checking to see that something is environmentally safe before they turn that over to the public. Now, I don't know that for sure, but I will check on that and get back with you to make sure. But I believe any time they transfer property over to the public, that they have to do an environmental assessment on that property, and it has to be cleaned up before they turn it over to the public. But like I say, not absolutely positive about that, but we'll verify that and get back with you on that.
Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I just got some an email to complete some of the answers on the questions. The amount of property involved is about 5 acres. That would be specified in any agreement for turning over the property. And the liability, environmental assessment and liability were discussed in the original due diligence report, which was part of the site criteria for when state parks first studied this. But that doesn't mean it would not still be a good idea to amend into the bill if people are still not feeling good about that.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you. But these are all good considerations. I guess the question as we move forward is, do we say you're authorized to go out and engage in a use agreement or a lease agreement and to operate it immediately? That would leave the ownership with the federal government. And if there are liability issues, we can negotiate to what the dollar amount of our potential liability is for operating it. But short of that, if we accept any responsibility for the maintenance of the facility, or we take ownership, either one, all of which take you back to ownership. I'd suggest to you that there's lots of exposures and issues there. I mean, when I look at this type of electrical equipment of that era, what I think of is PCBs and electrical. A lot of those equipments had very substantial environmental potentials, and I'm certain that one would be certain that they were maintained well, but you could blow your budget 1 year having to come down and remediate those issues. So the ordinarily liability follows ownership, so I would encourage the body to think in terms of we don't accept or authorize acceptance of ownership until the liability issues are resolved in advance.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. And I don't want to belabor. I think this discussion has been extremely valuable. I sat here and took an awfully lot of notes because we've already got a couple of other questions in and calls in to the military. And we're hoping to come back with some second reading amendments for that. And these are also issues that we do need to take into consideration. I kind of wanted to underscore something that my good colleague from Cheyenne mentioned, which is the level of volunteer support. It was quite amazing in that packed committee room to see all of these people saying, I would like to help with that. It was also very interesting to see the amount of resources that people in the private sector indicated they might be able to contribute to that. And so that to me was heartening. I appreciate the discussion. I appreciate all of this input, and we will certainly be working on bringing some second reading amendments should you choose to allow this to go forward, which I certainly hope you will. Thank you.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, one question that I would hope that we could have answered by the second reading would be the question is whether the State Historic Preservation Office, if we designate this historic site, then falls under the jurisdiction of the federal government. Here's my long-term concern with this. Once you designate this a historic site, you're under full obligation in perpetuity to maintain that facility as it is today. With any type of infrastructure, there is a tremendous long-term commitment to do this. The expenditures are not going to come out now and 5 years from now. It's going to be the maintenance of that entire infrastructure as it looks today. That's a requirement under the National Historic Preservation Act. The question I really think needs to be answered here is if our state can designate that a state historical object, is it the responsibility of the federal government? The way I read the National Historic Preservation Act, if it's a federal facility and the state nominates that as a historic resource, then it's the obligation of the federal government to maintain that facility. So in some aspects, this just looks like it's shifting the obligation of that over onto the state so they don't have to maintain that facility with the guise that we're going to fill it with concrete. So I really want the question answered. Number one, is it eligible for registration on the historic places? And number two, can the state historical preservation officer designate that as a historical facility? If that happens, the way I read the National Historic Preservation Act, it's the obligation of the federal government to maintain that facility.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Cooper's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 5. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 5 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 25. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 25, Cease and Transfer Priority List, sponsored by the Minerals Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Cole Cooper Rothfuss Von Flateren, Senator Von Flateren, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Flateren.
I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 25. There is an amendment to this bill. I'd like it read in at this time.
Senate File 25, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 3, line 11.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 25. And to explain the amendment real quick, it is just a technical cleanup. On page 3 of line 11, we just changed, they wrote a C in, as in Charlie, when they meant to write a T as in transfer. And on page 7, they cited the wrong part of the chapters, and they meant to delete 52 and insert 91. So it's a cleanup by mostly LSO, and I ask for your favorable vote on this amendment. Question?
We're ready for the question on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Von Flateren's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 25, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? No. That amendment has passed. We're back on the bill.
And to explain this bill, I'll call on Senator Cooper.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fellow senators, in 2013, the legislature created the Municipal Solid Waste Cease and Transfer Program. Under this program, the DEQ worked with the Office of State Lands and Investments to provide funding for 75% of the estimated cost for landfill operators who wish to cease receipt of municipal solid waste and transfer it to regional landfills. The operators are eligible for this 75%, as I mentioned, and of the estimated 75% of the estimated project, which is either in a mixture of grants or loans. In December of 2013, the DEQ prepared a prioritized list of qualified projects based on factors such as whether the facility was running out of disposable capacity and whether the facility was ready to close. This list was incorporated into Senate File Number 43, which was approved in the 2014 session. That list included 52 potentially eligible projects with a total estimated cost of $96,246,800. To date, the legislature has provided a total of $20,500,000 in funding for the program. That's in this cease and transfer account that we already have. $14,909,000 was for grants, and $5,591,000 was for loans. Also in 2014, the legislative session, the budget bill put a the Appropriation Committee put a restriction on the funding of these projects that said that only the first 21 projects listed on there on the priority list would be able to be funded at any one time. The first opportunity for funding under the program was in May 6th of 2014. One applicant was the Bighorn County South facility was determined to be eligible for funding a project with a total estimated eligible cost of $1,125,000, and then the State Loan Investment Board awarded of this request, they awarded it about $1,068,000 in a grant and about $56,000 in a loan. On October the 2nd, 2014, the SLIB then met and again addressed three applications for funding. All the applicants were determined to be eligible by the DEQ and receive recommendations for funding. Total SLIB awarded about $5 million in grants and about $248,000 in loans for these three projects. These were the Lusk Project, the Wheatland Project, and the Teton County Project. In total, about $6 million has been approved in grants and about $303,000 in loans. Now, what that does, that leaves, when you take all these out of the $20,500,000 total that was available, that leaves $8.8 million remaining in the grant fund, $5.3 million left in the loan fund, for a total remaining balance in the cease and transfer account of about $14.1 million for future projects. Based on the funding of the four projects and the DEQ's determination that there were two facilities they found to be ineligible for funding because they were actually completed or processed before the cutoff period, I think was 2005 or 6, for funding under the program. So the priority list was updated to account for the facilities dropping off the list and the other projects moving up. One project was added to the list, the Lusk Transfer Station. The Lusk Transfer Station previously had secured some funding through the Mineral Royalties Grant and the USDA, but it proved that, like a lot of the federal programs these days, would be a bit flighty and decided that they probably weren't going to be successful with those, so that was added to the priority list. The new priority list contains 47 projects for an estimated total cost of now in the future of about $89.5 million. So we've got $20,500,000 in that program. This money is placed so that the SLIB board can use this money on recommendation from the DEQ, and that's where we stand on this priority list. Now, the priority list, just every time a project is completed, then the next group of projects move up the priority list. That's the way it works.
Questions? Question has been called on Senate File 25. All those in favor of Senator Von Flatern's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 25, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 25 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Senator Ogden Driscoll, sir, you may have the pleasure of the floor, if you would be kind enough to introduce my wife, who's in the gallery. There she is.
Would you like me to take the chair and have you do it?
If you would just...
Ladies and gentlemen, Senator, I can use his name, Senator Emmerich's wife, Karen, is our guest today, the beautiful Karen Emmerich. So she going to cook a good meal now?
Thank you, Senator. The next bill for our consideration, Senate File 34. The reading clerk, please read in the bill.
Senate File 34, Interstate Mining Compact Commission Membership, sponsored by the Minerals Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Anderson, 28, Cole, Cooper, Rothfuss, Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Senator Von Flatern.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 34. There is an amendment. I ask that it be read in at this time.
Senate File 34, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 21, line 18.
Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, Senate File 34, and to explain that, I will do that quickly so we can dispense with it. It goes into page 21, line 18, and the whole object of this bill is to make us a full member of the Mining Commission, National Mining Commission. And what this amendment does is lets all mining pay for it, not just surface coal mining, but all mining which is encompassed in this. So I ask for the vote on the amendment, and then I will move the bill over.
Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Von Flader's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Number 1, Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 34, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment is passed. Senator Von Flader.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're back on the bill, so I'll give it. I'll yield the floor now to Senator Anderson, 28.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, this bill just authorizes us to join the Interstate Mining Compact Commission as a full member. We have been a member of this commission since 2005 as an associate member, and your dues come up every year that you're an associate member. We are now to that point that we're paying full member dues, and the only thing we don't have now is the vote on the Interstate Commerce Commission. Our governor will be the person that has the vote, and we'll be paying the same amount of dues. The dues are paid by the OSM, the funds from the OSM, so it is not a cost to the state of Wyoming. The information in this bill is the information that has to be put in for the Interstate Mining Compact Commission, but I would like to have you look at page 4, kind of encapsulates what this is all about. Page 4, line 10 through 16, it's encouraging with due recognition of relevant regional, physical, and other differences, programs in each of the party states which will achieve comparable results in protecting, conserving, and improving the usefulness of natural resources to the end that the most desirable conduct of mining and related operations may be universally facilitated. Then it goes on to say there on line 20 that so that much use of the may be consistent with the sound land use, public health, and public safety. It's all about reclamation and the use of the land afterwards also. And we have been a member of this for some time. I know a lot of the mine guys that have gone to this commission and come back with real good ideas on reclamation and how to take care of the land after the mining has been done. It's a useful compact commission. 22 states are members, full members, and four are associate members, of which they are slowly becoming full-time members also. We did not get a list of all the members, but you can imagine that it's all the mining states. Everything else is kind of explained in the bill and kind of needed to meet the commission's rulings. Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and I'll admit I'm fairly ignorant on this particular compact, but sometimes in interstate compacts we can wind up preempting some of our own laws. We can wind up being rigidly tied to an interstate compact. This one looks to be just study and that sort of thing. But do we have consequences for existing laws and practices that we've got on the books?
Senator Von Flader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. An answer to a tall senator from Natrona County. No, actually, this has no power to write our laws or change our laws. They can certainly give information to say you probably in an arid climate you should do this versus that and have conferences and meetings about it and have the experts talk to us, but it doesn't trump any of our own rules and regs.
Are you ready for the question? Question having been... Senator Nicholas.
What is the difference between the dues as we currently are acting and what will the full dues be?
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, the dues are paid out of funds from the OSM. Our dues are right now $45,000. That is the dues for a full member. And we've been an associate member for 10 years now, and that's the graduation up to the 45,000. We are at the 45,000 level now, and we should be voting members.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
I apologize. I didn't understand when you say that dues are paid by or out of OSM. It doesn't make any sense to me. Could you explain that?
Senator Von Flater.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you look at that, where the amendment came in, the actual amendment says that we get grants from the OSM, and they can be used, the state's writing the grant, that they can be used to pay that membership. Should those grants cease, then it also, in that same paragraph on page 21 or whatever, it says that the permits from mining can also be used to pay our membership. That's why it doesn't change, doesn't cost the state anything to be a member. Present associate member dues are the $45,000 without voting rights. So now we get voting rights as being a full member, and our dues do not rise.
Mr. President.
My only concern with that is when I hear the Office of State or the Office of Surface Management involved in providing grants and then offsets and allocations and permits, I think of federal mineral royalties. And I'd just like some assurances that a better explanation of what's happening here with respect to what's happening with the relationship with OSM to pay our dues to an organization.
Senator Von Flater.
Mr. Chairman, that's a great question. They are grants that have been coming and paying for our dues because that's one of the ways you can use the grants. But that's a great question to find out how they're interconnected, and I'll get back to you tomorrow on that. Thank you.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Von Flater's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 34, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 34 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate Joint Resolution Number 2. Would the reading clerk please read it in?
Senate Joint Resolution 2, Investment of State Funds, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Hastert, Ross, Wasserberger, excuse, Senator Perkins, Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Ross, what is your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate Joint Resolution 2, Investment of State Funds, and for a discussion of this bill, I yield to the floor manager, the senator from Sweetwater County.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate. I am bringing before you Senate Joint Resolution Number 2. This is one that the state treasurer has been looking at and talking about for quite a little while and different thoughts and ideas about this. Wyoming's total portfolio currently stands at nearly $19 billion, which is divided between the state agency pool, which holds the state general funds, as well as several other accounts, such as the LISRA, the Game and Fish Trust account, the Highway Trust, Wildlife Trust, Cultural Resources, Public Broadcast, Miners Hospital, just to name a few, and a various permanent funds account like the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund in the Hathaway. The permanent funds, members of the Senate, can be invested in around 50% equities and fixed incomes and have enjoyed a total of about an 8% return over the past 5 years, while the state agency pool is constitutionally prohibited from investing in anything other than fixed income assets with a total return of about 4% over the same period of time. Last year, the state agency pool yielded about 2.9%, while the permanent mineral trust fund yielded about 6.5%. And now, you know, last year was an exceptionally good year, and that's not always going to be the case. The proposed amendment would allow the legislature, to designate certain funds to be more broadly invested with the purpose of improving defensive management and the potential for better return. These funds obviously would require a two-thirds vote of each chamber and then voted on by the people of Wyoming with the intent to be more liquid than the permanent funds. The main purpose of doing this are for a better defensive posture and improved prospects for return. And then just a note on bonds and other fixed income instruments are also risky. So the idea that bonds-only portfolio is inherently safer than a more broadly diverse one is not correct. There is a potential opportunity cost for not having some equity exposure, which can be seen in the difference of returns from the permanent mineral trust fund. And then it just historically, members of the Senate, you know, if you looked at, and it, you can look, take any type of investment on a spot check on a 1 year type basis, and you can find fluctuations there. But over a period of time, some exposure to equity will always outperform the fixed incomes only. And that's the reason that the state treasurer is proposing this and asked that we support this, so he has that ability, members of the Senate. We heard quite a little bit of discussion around this in the committee, and you know, it certainly made sense that having this ability would put Wyoming in a better position than some of these other funds that aren't yielding much at all. So that's what we're trying to do with the bill, and I'll stand for questions.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this is an important piece of legislation, and I've been given a lot of thought since it was discussed and proposed by the state treasurer. I guess just, if I may, give my general feeling with respect to what we're doing, and then we have to talk about how we're going to get to the end. But in general, when you hear that there is potentially a tens of millions of dollars, not tens of millions, but $11 million or so in pooled income that are outside of the permanent mineral trust fund and the retirement accounts that are maintained on behalf of state employees, and that those funds are restricted by investment by the terms of Article 16, Section 6, which provides currently that that neither the state, county, city, townships, et cetera, school districts may own capital stock of any association or corporation except that funds of the public employee system and permanent mineral trust funds can be invested in there. So the point was that prior to that time, it was viewed by the taxpayers that you tax yourselves as much as you need, and when their money goes to the state government, that the money is held there until services are paid for. In a sense, you're sending money down to the state government thinking, believing that they're only collecting as much as necessary to run government. And if that's the case, you would not want your state government out investing in equities, because if they chose to put, if the treasurer thought, well, gee, I could put this money in a stock company, and I think that it's going to double in value, and I'm going to double my money, and then next year we won't have tax at all. Well, what happens if they're wrong? And it goes the other direction. and it goes down, all of a sudden when you go to write those checks, there's no money there. And so when you begin to look at what's in the, say, $10 billion worth of pooled monies, you have some big categories that deserve special attention, and I would give examples. One is the statutory amount collected for the Wildlife Trust Fund. Well, we believe that that's going to be there a pretty significantly long period of time, and how we invest that is on a long view. But much of the funds are, for example, there's probably $1 billion sitting in those accounts for school capital construction. That is money that you've appropriated for schools that are in the planning stage and later expected to go to the construction phase. But you know that those funds are encumbered. They're encumbered for a project. And if you've got your funds in the stock market, if we have a collapse like we saw in 2008, end of 2008 to 2009, you go to the Treasury and you go and say, look, where's my money from my school? Well, in October of this year, we just had a decline of 30%, so you can't write that check. And so when our Constitution was put together by our forefathers, they understood this. They understood that there is significant volatility in the stock market, and they restricted the treasurer and the from investing in these accounts, because what they really said, it's no different than if you say, I'm going to buy a car next month. You take that money out and you put in a passbook, hopefully one that's insured. And so when you go write your check, the check is there. But if you put it in the stock market, you buy your car, you bring it home, the next day you go to draw it out, the stock market dropped that night. How do you pay for your car? Well, now you've got to go out and work a little harder to make up the difference. Well, what that means in the government situation, it means coming back to the taxpayers and say, we got to collect some more money here because we encumbered these funds. We have a contract out there. The high school is half done, and, gee, we don't have enough money to pay for it. So what's happening? Well, what's happening is that, you know, we're in a pretty good run of things, and that is, I don't know what our colleague from Education Committee could tell us, but I would suspect there's probably $1 to $1.5 billion of cash sitting in the bank to pay for capital construction that we've approved that's not yet been completed and constructed. So, for example, you could walk down and go to Casper and you see two high schools. We probably spent 20% to 30% of that money, but the other 60% is still sitting in the bank. You've got buildings at university. You've got highways out there. We're sitting at any given time on highways that are planned for next year. You put that in the stock market, and then the next summer your stock market drops, and all of a sudden you can't pay the checks. So are there certain things that we intended to be in, have in a category that is the equivalent of cash? Well, here's the dilemma, the flip side of that. The dilemma is that when that's a lot of money to have sitting anywhere, and no matter where you put it, it's a certain amount of risk. You put it in a bank, there's a certain amount of risk that the bank would go broke. Historically, the risk that we've witnessed over time is that most of our investments are probably in treasury bonds. And there was a time where treasury bonds were yielding pretty good, and you could buy them and sell them without a lot of loss. Well, the treasurer says, you know, that's no longer the case now. Treasury bonds go up and down. They're traded, and your corpus is at risk. And that's part of the point. When we look at the Permanent Wyoming Mineral Trust Fund, we're going for a long-term investment. We put at risk a portion of the corpus, because we're looking at investment income, and we believe that by inflation-proofing it, that the corpus will be grow over time. There are some things where you're not supposed to put your corpus at risk, that the corpus itself is intended to be there for when the checks are drawn. But, again, we're in a situation where we have about $10 billion sitting out there, which you think is a lot of money. In some sense, it's not a lot of, if you're every year you're kicking through $2.5-3 billion of revenue. So when you look at Article 6, you have full limitations. And then when you look over at the other parts of the Constitution, when you look at the Permanent Mental Trust Fund, we've given pretty broad authority to the Treasurer to invest in almost anything. But then when you go look at the language we created for the Hathaway accounts, and excuse me a minute, but I'll find it. But if you look at the trust the language we did for the Hathaway endowments, we said there, Treasurer, you're allowed to go out and do this, but you need to create a spending policy reserve account. You have to invest it in ways that will try to achieve a certain protection to make sure that we can write checks every month or every year to the students. Because we were focused on a little bit different. We didn't want a trust that would fall below and not be able to write checks for students. So we put some more restrictions on. Here, we're talking about pooled income, much of which is designed to be there, the corpus needs to be there to write the check, and we have no restrictions or protections on it. Actually, we do have some limitation. It has to come back to the legislature, but the legislature is in no position to be called in for long-term investments. So your legislature of the future will be called in to say, okay, what is your investment policy? How much of the corpus should be cash? How much should it not be cash? What percentage of the corpus do you put at risk? Well, I submit to you that one of the things we ought to consider before second and third reading is whether or not we should put some provision or some mandate that future legislatures do an estimate of the amount of cash demand of corpus that they're required to have and make sure that those dollars are not at risk. Or provide some other protection to ensure that the corpus is already there. But to blindly set out a provision right now because we see that one account, that the account that we've gone to equities is producing more income than the other is a little bit quick. Now remember again, you can't say, well, the PMTF drew 6.8%. PMTF dropped $1 billion in 1 year in corpus. What if that happened to your pooled income? $1 billion of corpus in your pooled income that is there to write check has got lost. Whose projects aren't going to get done? Maybe we ought to put a provision that says, all the counties except Albany get to suffer. I don't think you'd go for that. But the problem is we would have people jumping up and we would have people saying, wait a minute, my project was not supposed to be at risk. So mostly your pool dollars are there because they're encumbered in some fashion. And I don't know that we've had a real good discussion with respect to how we're going to protect that risk. And if we do put in equities and there's a huge drop, how are we going to make up those equities? Or that loss in corpus for projects that should have been paid for?
Mr. Majority, floor leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And most of the points that our president brought forward are good points. But this is good that we have this kind of discussion. I want to go back to 1996 and the debate we had back then in the House and in the Senate when we brought to the vote of the people to further expand and allow the Permanent Mental Trust Fund to get into capital stocks. And what my colleague from Albany County talks about, we lost $1 billion in 2008-09. I didn't think it was quite that much, but whatever the amount, it was huge, a big impact. But if you look over the growth from 1996 to where we are today, if we'd have kept the Permanent Mental Trust Fund and allowed it only to be invested as it was, which is pretty much treasuries and with banks or whatever, the fund I would submit to you, and I can't tell you exactly, would be worth probably 50% of what it is today. So when the state of Wyoming was presented that opportunity to vote to invest in the capital stocks, and back then, if you recall, we were broke. That's when the state had no money. We had great debate, but we decided that it was a prudent thing to do to move forward because long term, if you're really going to grow, you can't grow on 1% a year. You have to get into the capital markets. Of course, this is a permanent fund. And that certainly is different. But out of that permanent fund, don't forget that it's responsible for anywhere from 18% to 23 or 24% of our revenues. So all the risk and all the tough decisions we had to make back then, whether to move this forward or not, are the same today relative to the pooled interest, only not quite to that extent. If we hadn't done that back then and gone to the capital investment, instead of having the 5% spending policy we have today and how that works and 2.5% we get and the 2.5% goes other places, you know, I would submit to you that instead of having $300 million, which I think is the amount we have, we might have 150 or 100, even with that $1 billion we took in 2009. So there's a lot of reasons to look at investments in the capital markets. Now, to speak specifically to this one, you know, the president is exactly right. This is different. And we had some discussion about this in the committee during the interim, and other members on the JAC can get involved and talk about this. We thought the protections we put in there, if you look at the permanent fund investment, it just said that's prescribed by the legislature. So we now, I think, probably invest 55% maybe in something like that in capital. I can't remember the ratio. My colleague from Natrona County, the chairman of that select committee, can tell us that. But that's as prescribed by the legislature, so a simple majority could change that. What we said here is to take two-thirds vote, just for the very reason that the president has talked about, to be sure that we don't have that happen where your favorite project, it gets time to write the check, and because we've got too aggressive, we don't have the money. So we tried to come with a balance to allow that to happen, have the two-thirds vote to be sure that we'd be prudent about it. But yet, if you don't invest part of that, and I'm saying part of it, as we determine into the capital markets, I think you're doing a disservice in terms of the overall revenue streams to the state. I would also talk a little bit about the language, and we talked about where to put this, and not being an attorney, I hate to see an article in the Constitution start out with the word notwithstanding. Now, I've had trouble with that, and where we should actually put this into the Constitution, but if you look at Section 13, it says the same thing, notwithstanding. So there's a precedent set there. And this is exactly the thing, though, that your interim committee struggled with, is how do you maintain that balance between knowing you need the money, not getting carried away to take advantage of the capital markets.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, great conversation. I guess, to clarify, my recollection is that in 2008, when we had the stock market crash, that even though we were limited by, 50% investment in the permanent Wyoming mineral trust funds, we lost about $1 billion of valuation in the corpus. Because of our conservative approach to management of our funds, we recouped about $500 million, about $500 million over the course of the next year. The stock market rebounded. To get the other $500 million worth of corpus back, though, you have to remember, you're now trying to get those earnings off a smaller corpus. So if you lose $500 million and you've got now less money to regain your corpus, it takes a long time. And that's part of the point. The permanent mineral trust fund is inviolate, and it stays there forever. And as a consequence, we're looking at incomes. Now, also, with respect to the PMTF, you need to be careful about those discussions because it is true that it's grown. But it grows because of statutory or constitutional contributions every year from the permanent mineral trust fund, from minerals, severance taxes. We have the statutory diversion. And we have appropriated some of our surpluses that were really derived from federal mineral royalties and severance taxes, other oil production. So we contribute a lot in order to build up that corpus. That's not true for your pooled income. Your pooled income was parked for a reason. The reason why it's in the pooled income is because it got parked for a purpose, and it's sitting in the treasurer's office waiting for that. But maybe a good way to have this discussion is let's talk about the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account. And let's assume for purposes of this discussion we have $2 billion in that account. What's the purpose of the LISRA? The purpose of the LISRA is that if you have a catastrophic revenues, a rainy day or a rainy day event that we've not yet defined, that there will be a pool of money to reach in and grab. And that it's essentially your lifeline for a period of time. And I've talked about saying, okay, if you know my theory of it is that a rainy day is a long-term event where your revenues are at plateau level or small growth, inflation is hitting it, and maybe you need to be able to dive in it for 10 years. So if you've got $2 billion or $3 billion, you can capture 1 year at a time revenues out of there, say $200 to $300 million per year to augment your budgets to get through this time. Well, if during that time, at the time that's you're most vulnerable, you have those funds invested in the stock market and the corpus takes a hit, and let's suppose, I just did the math, $1 billion to $4.5, that was a 22% stock market drop. A lot of folks were seeing 40%, 30% drops in the stock market that year. So you lose 30% of your corpus, you just lost your lifeline. The thing that was supposed to be your most protected source of revenue has just lost its corpus. And not only do you just don't have it there to grab. And you don't have the time to earn back that money to grab your corpus because it's not inviolate. That's the whole point. It's not inviolate. It was there to be there. And we allowed these investments in the higher education endowment. By the way, those accounts you'll find at Article 15, Section 20. And there what we said is, as a condition for investing in this, the legislature may also provide for use of earnings to protect the funds from inflation and to even fluctuations of earnings over time. The funds may be invested in the same manner as the permanent funds of the state. So we actually put some restrictions in to try to figure out what the rules of the road are. But as much debate as we're having here just on the constitutional change, what confidence do we have that as we're moving forward that folks will think about and remember the lessons of the past and what's the purpose? Part of what we always, in fact, I'd actually ask for the sponsors, we could do this, is ask the treasurer to provide us a profile of the pool of funds, which I think are about $11.5 billion. But you're going to find that some of those are highway funds. Some of those are construction projects being held. Some of them are the school foundation program account. Some of them are the $2 billion reserves. And when you begin to look at this, you're going to start seeing that these are monies that are not going to be there long enough to get to go through investment cycles to recover. Now, as long as the point of the treasurer making is pretty important. That is, if you got $10 billion there, you're adding into them about as fast as you're spending. So that $10 billion might take 5 years to spend. And you know, the check that you write next month may not be the same dollar that you put in 5 years ago. So the treasurer says, look, if I've got $10 billion there, all I need to know is what are my cash demands for the next 6 months? And what are they for the next year? And if my cash demands are $500 million, that's what I need to have liquid. And if I, over the next year, I need to have $1.5 billion, then I need to have that. And the rest I can put into longer investments. Fair enough. That makes sense. But the character of those dollars is such that you really don't want to put them at risk. And while we have great confidence in our current treasurer, I don't know if we'll always have that. And this is a constitutional change, so we really need to make sure we're careful with respect to the limitations of monies on how we invest monies that are intended to be there for the corpus.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what you have to look at is what's basically called modern portfolio theory of an investment. And basically what that is don't put all your eggs in one basket. And I think that really what really determines whether or not you're going to have prudent investment is the same thing that I think that the good senator from Cody remarked to when we had this debate in the 90s was that you had the prudent investor rule. And I think the good senator could probably explain that better than I can, so I'm going to leave that to a different time. But frankly, the situation is that when our, learned colleagues of yesteryear, 125 years ago or so, decided that we were going to use bonds to fund these things, they had no idea at all that we're going to have a Federal Reserve system that was going to have a 0% return on bonds. And frankly, folks, we've done a good job shortening our duration in our bond portfolio. So when the interest rates do and whatever goes down goes up, eventually they're going to go up. Well, when interest rates goes up and you have a bond that's making 0.1% and that bond goes up to making 1%, your bond is worth 10% of what it used to be, and these things are in 100% bonds. You have to have diversification in your investment to spread your risk. And that's what this does. Now, I do agree 100% with the president that there are accounts within this pooled interest universe that do not lend themselves to investment in the stock market. Those things should probably be in 90-day treasurers at the most, and you're not making any money, but you know that your money is safe and you're going to be able to pay your bills. But on the other hand of it, that there are essentially trust funds and trust and agency accounts out there. A lot of them aren't big. Some of them are 20 million, 70 million. You add them all up, you can do a heck of a lot with another 3 or 4% interest rate if you have a modern portfolio and it's diversified. And that's what we're moving into. So yes, we need to move cautiously and getting all the information that we need to make those decisions on as far as which accounts should maybe go forward and which accounts shouldn't, so, and work over this over the next year, get everybody educated as to what we should be doing and move forward cautiously. But frankly, we need to move forward because all that money's in bonds, interest rates are going to go up. Even though it's a short duration of 90 days, 6 months, a year, you can't afford to wait a year till that thing matures to write the check, because you're going to lose your corpus just as easy in bonds as you can in the stock market.
Minority floor leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of comments, and then I do have a couple of questions. The first comment is the fact that we do have an excellent treasurer right now, and hopefully we'll have good treasurers in the future, but we certainly have to have oversight over that and manage it. But the reality is a cash flow approach to the budgetary needs of the state would allow a substantial portion of our agency pool to be invested because we will never touch those dollars. As cash flow, as cash comes in and cash goes out, that cash flow is relatively stable over the course of the year, and we can maintain a substantial portion of what we have in that agency pool invested any way we want because we'll just never touch the funds. It's not the nature of how our state brings funds in and moves funds out. So that analysis can certainly be done, and it can be done in a conservative manner where we make sure that we have it backstopped with a substantial amount of money for uncertainty, really $500 million backstop, something along those lines, and we're going to be in good shape. The concern that I have and the reason that I like the concept of this legislation is that if you look at the LISROL by itself at $2 billion, if you're getting a 6%-ish yield out of the permanent funds, out of the equities in the market, and you're getting a 2% out of the agency pool, that delta there is about 4%. Well, that's $80 million per year on the LISRA. That's $80 million that we could have access to, we could be using for programs, and even to us, $80 million is a good bit of money. So it's something we certainly have to consider, but we do have to be cautious about it. Now, the questions I have is really with how this would be implemented and the language used. I get the concept, but my curiosity is the way the language is written, it's a little bit ambiguous as to whether or not establishing a fund requires two-thirds majority of both chambers, or if allocating money to the fund requires a two-thirds majority of both chambers. In other words, you would have to have that vote outside of the budget. You couldn't have a steady stream going to it that continuously feeds it. So I'm curious whether that's what's meant. Which one of those two things is meant? Because if we just have to establish the creation of a fund with two-thirds, but then we get to fill it with 50% of each chamber, that really doesn't make sense in terms of providing that check against the system, Mr. Chairman, and ensuring that we're investing prudently. So I'd like some clarification there, and maybe I'm misreading the language. And the other question would be expenditures from that account. Now, if I'm taking money away from that account that goes to the corpus, do I need a two-thirds majority of each chamber voting separately to draw funds from the corpus of that, or how do I handle interest or accrual off of that account? I, there's a little uncertainty here where I'm not getting exactly how it would play out if we passed it based on this language, and I'm hoping the sponsors could enlighten me on that.
Senator Perkins, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just trying to answer that question and give maybe a little bit of context over the last little while. The state, as has been discussed at length, the state has considerable amount of money that are not considered to be permanent funds. And so because they're not permanent funds, again, they cannot be invested in stocks. Or about the only thing you can do is fixed income is about the only thing it can be invested in. Those comprised the major portion of that. Last time I looked, is the common agency pool, which is a pooled income fund or pooled fund, and there was about $6 billion. Now that includes the LISRA and some other things like that. Monies that already been appropriated or otherwise done that's been waiting to be spent on this or that, and then there's some other funds and that continue in there. But when you go, just to give you an example, a year ago, the Treasurer's Office, in an effort anticipating that interest rates would go up, looked, because we had a lot of fixed incomes in our portfolio that were in excess of what the current market rate was. So we had quite a few bonds that were averaging 4 or 5% over the long term. And the Treasurer looking at it says, you know, if the interest rates go up, then if we ever have to go and sell off those bonds, then we'll only get back maybe what we put into them. But if we can sell them now, we can sell them at a substantial premium because of what the market. So he did that last year. When there was about $120 million of capital gains that came from just anticipating the interest rates might go up. We had some discussion in this floor, Mr. Chairman, about whether those funds ought to be expanded as a part of the overall budget, or whether some of us talked about whether they should just go back in and reinforce the corpus and some of these funds, or whether they ought to flow in and be part of the general fund and be expended. And so we've kind of had some of this discussion. This year, I mean, at one point in time, this year has not been as bad as some of us thought, as thoughts might have been. But this year there were early on about $80 million in losses from this very fund, but we had funds last year. The point is that this goes up and this goes down. Sometimes you can get profit off these things. Sometimes you're going to have capital losses. But just simply investing them in fixed incomes anymore is no longer deemed to be safe, mostly because our interest rates have been pushed low. Some would say artificially low, but nevertheless they're so low that any migration of those rates up results in substantial risk and loss of the corpus. So you come up with this idea that maybe what we ought to do is, ultimately, the portfolio is much about risk. And as we talk about extensively in the Capital Finance Committee, allocating the risk you do it generally through apportionment and allocation of your portfolio into various forms. Some investments in fixed income, some investments in certain sectors, some investments in certain types of instruments. Those things all are different allocations that go into modern portfolio management theory. And it's all about
spreading and finding and managing your risk. And so whether there's going to be, and the risk is, no pun intended, actually pun intended, the risk of allocating risk is you can be wrong. But it is allocating that and trying to hedge against all the different things that can go wrong. And even doing nothing, if you have severe inflationary pressures, even doing nothing can result in significant erosion of what your assets are. So that brings us to what this bill is trying to do. And the intent is ultimately that it would be similar to the process would be similar if this bill were to pass as to what had happened in the investments of some of the other funds. If you go back and look, I think Article 9, Administration of Government, you go into Article 7, Investment of Public Funds, and you get down there, we talk about that. But ultimately, it comes back, and I think the intent was that ultimately, if it were to pass, then it comes back, and the legislature, by two-thirds vote of the members of each house separately, may authorize the investment of funds not designated as permanent funds in the same manner as permanent funds of the state. So what would happen is it would come back, and the House would have to vote. There would be a bill that would come out and say, these are going to be we can put the different protections. We can put other kinds of requirements on them we think appropriate for these types of funds. We can do lots of different things. But what we would do is it's going to take two-thirds on this side on a bill and two-thirds on the other side to agree on what that would be. Ultimately, we set the parameters of those funds and the parameters of what those investments ought to be. But the actual implementation of the investment policy is a function of not just the treasurer, but the SLIB board, the State Loan and Investment Board, so which is the five electeds and their staff. They actually comprise the investment policy within the guidelines of the statutory bounds that have been set, and it's the State Loan and Investment Board and their staff, not just the treasurer, that then is responsible for implementing the investment policy and making sure that those allocations are met. And it's something that's going to take a period of time. Even as we have income that comes in even now, you don't just simply launch into the market and buy a bunch of stuff on one day. There's a method to the madness that they use downstairs as they do that, figure out when and what's appropriate and how they allocate that among the various money managers and how they manage their risk. But it is ultimately the entire process about whether you're investing in is spreading that risk. And in some instances, there are certain other vehicles of investment that can be no more risky, if not even less risky, than we find ourselves in fixed income these days. But ultimately, if this passes and moves off, make no mistake, this will be back to us, because ultimately, if it passes, it's up to the legislature to set the bounds under which this goes. And we'll have a much further and more in-depth discussion on safeguards, what ought to be and what ought not to be. And there'll be a lot more talk about this if this does pass in the future.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've pretty well talked quite a bit about the protection of the funds, the issues. I think it is. I think one of the things that's change, you can't simply say, well, this policy has worked for 100 years, why are we changing it? And one of the things that we do know is fiscal and monetary policies change. Parking all your money in treasury bonds has a risk. I acknowledge those things. I just believe that in this instance, for pooled money, the first and foremost issue ought to be preservation of the corpus. That ought to drive your policy. And I think we ought to look at this statute really carefully and maybe incorporate some protections in it to make sure that our priorities are lined out and that the people that call upon to vote for this get to say, okay, you can diversify your portfolio, but first and foremost, we want preservation of corpus. That is our intention. And if that's the case, specify. I would like, though, before we also leave today, is to have a discussion about what the committee felt with respect to cities, towns, counties, school districts. So we've made this exception available to ourselves, but we're not making it to the local governments. In many instances, they sit on funds that may be their enterprise funds. They may be building funds for a future expenditure anticipated 10 years from the road. Did the committee consider that? Why did we make the carve out this exception only for the state? Should the if we find the right language, should we expand it?
Mr. Minority Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer that last question, this entire discussion, by the way, it's been a great discussion by the Senate, was brought to us by the State Treasurer and I believe probably our Select Committee on Capital Investments working together on it. And no, we did not talk about cities, towns, and counties and to afford them the same opportunity. Not saying it shouldn't be discussed, but we did not, and that was the reason we did not.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I've not been involved in the development of this amendment, and I've been listening to this debate with considerable interest and speaking on and for the amendment. It seems to me a couple of points are particularly sound. First, when you have a large body of money you're trying to manage, you want to have diversity in your investments, because you can lose money in this day and age in a fixed income U.S. Treasury bond quite readily, and people do, and institutions do. You need to have diversity available in terms of your tool. And I think the real debate is not preservation of corpus or not preservation of corpus. The real debate is how much liquidity do you need to maintain in any particular account or aggregation of accounts at any one time. And what this amendment does is give us some more tools available so that we can better diversify. And it gives us a tool particularly that has proved over the long run to be a much better long-run investment. But you've got to balance that off in the particular accounts against the short-term liquidity needs. And you have to be conservative on that, and hence the two-thirds requirement in here in terms of what the policies are. So I think that's the sideboard you need in the Constitution. Now, it would be a different debate when we're saying, should X part be invested in common stock? Then you have to talk about liquidity and how much have you aggregated things and what are the offsetting risks and what might you need to spend in the next 2 years or 4 years, because we do know that over a short period, like 2 to 4 years, stock market things can go way down, and you need to preserve that liquidity. So I think in some sense we're getting a little ahead of ourselves in trying to debate the specifics of how much liquidity we need, when what we're really trying to do is give ourselves the tools so that we can prudently invest the money in these pooled funds. And, Mr. Chairman, I've been persuaded by this debate that this amendment's a good thing, but when we come to the actual implementation of it with the specific funds, we're going to need to have a degree of caution, have some very robust debates, not so much on the preservation of corpus, but in terms of ensuring we have adequate liquidity to do what we need to with the funds over relatively shorter periods of time, like year, 2 years, and 5 years.
Mr. Minority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to reiterate the question, the previous question that I had about how all of this works, and I'll ask the Chairman of the Appropriations Committee if he can specifically lay out how expenditures would be made, what the authorization would be, how fund allocation to a fund that's been designated would be carried out, and what the required vote would be, and assuming that it's not just the designation of the fund. So if I can get clarification there, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, A couple things that we've talked about today that give me great concern about moving forward at the speed and whether this is an interim topic that we need to spend more time or whether while we have our creative juices at a heightened capacity, whether we try to get it out this this period or get it out this session. I believe that we are most creative while we're here, and we ought to work this bill for a while, but we ought to also take a look at it by the time we get to third reading and say, does this accomplish it? But I understand the argument being made by my our colleague from Petrona County when you articulate the notion that this is a really we need to focus on our liquidity. And that would be true if none of the funds were encumbered. So that, for example, if you're focused on the LISRA account, or if you are focused on the Wildlife Trust Fund, you could say, well, those funds we don't expect to draw out. We're just looking, what we're really looking at is earnings until we need them. And we're prepared to sacrifice some risk for overall income. Now, there's going to be no inflation proofing here, by the way, folks, because when you start thinking about inflation proofing that we talked about and the permanent minimum funds, there we have a practice of putting monies back into the corpus. So investment earnings are put into a spending policy reserve account. Money goes back to inflation-proof the corpus. There is no similar mechanism for pooled funds because for pooled funds, all the interest goes into the general fund and just gets spent. It's part of it. When you look at your goldenrod, there's a portion of the revenues in there that come from investment earnings. If we want to treat this as a trust fund and we say, okay, we're going to have spending policy reserve accounts and we're going to inflation-proof our corpus, things like that that are concepts that we built for permanent minimum funds, that would be a different discussion. So if we talk about a statutory trust like the Wildlife Trust Fund, are we going to create sprawl accounts, inflation-proofing, things like that? Good question to have for future legislators. But with respect to those dollars that are encumbered, that have been set aside for projects, those should always be liquid because many of you have schools out there that the funds for which were appropriated 2 or 3 years ago, and they've not been deployed. Or you have schools that are in construction phase that there may be 20% done, 80% is going to be drawn out. There's no discussion about what needs to be liquid there. It has to be inviolate. Those monies have to be there when you draw them. And so it is a difficult discussion. When we talk about, well, if we had this money in an account, we would have a delta, a spread between what we're presently garnering for investment income of 4%. Well, that's looking at current investments of the liquid versus the permanent mineral trust fund. Well, the permanent mineral trust fund, again, you're not going to be investing these in the same kind of long-term dollars. They're going to be shorter term. They're going to be more conservative. They're going to be things that are not as risky. So your delta might only be 2% or 1%. And you're putting a lot of risk to get a differential of 1 or 2%. Certainly it makes a difference on whether we're in low interest, high interest, what the inflation looks like. There are a lot of issues there, but these are complicated discussions, and there are lots of dollars in these pooled incomes that represent different things, and we just need to be very cautious of what we're prepared to allow future legislators to do, because given natural greed, people are going to want to try to get this high of income as they can. And if it's not your project that's at risk, you want to make money on the other guy's project so that there'd be more interest so you could spend it. That's just human nature, and we need to make sure we avoid that.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of... with regards to the question posed by the good minority floor leader, I'm not sure that question can be answered at this point in time. I think that's the discussion for future legislatures. The questions that have been raised by the good president, I raised with the treasurer during testimony in Appropriations Committee. And there could possibly be some qualifying language that we may wish to add to this. Is there some sort of cap? Certainly, the points that the president made are appropriate. There is a need to make sure that we do have the ability to pay for our obligations. But by the same token, you must balance what we're doing here, which is simply a constitutional amendment, and what kind of language goes out to the public, and whether or not they would be able to understand what the constitutional amendment is or requires. And so the language that you see is fairly consistent with what we did when we decided to invest in equities in the Permanent Mental Trust Fund. Perhaps we should put some qualifying language in there. We can. But I would ask you to remember to try to balance that with what a voter will see when they read that constitutional amendment, and will that, so to speak, queer the deal? So, that's a bad term. Sorry. In any event, I'd ask for your favorable consideration of this.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to try and answer the good minority leader's question directly, for significantly, both in statute in 94715, it's the only overreaching limitation is no more than 55% in equities. But what we get down is 94716 is where the state investment policy is drafted, and ultimately it's in large part delegated to the State Loan and Investment Board with some generally policy statements. Including the board may specify groupings of state funds for which separate investment policy statements are appropriate. At a minimum, the grouping shall include state funds for which there is a trust obligation, short-term funds for obligations and other funds, and the board may determine criteria under which certain funds may be separately managed. Then nothing in the section is construed to prevent the state treasurer from pooling state funds for investment purposes, including meeting cash flow requirements in accordance with approved policy statements. And then it talks about the investment policy statements, and then we want them to include nominal return benchmarks, definition of risk and return, risk tolerance, permissible investments and quality standards, liquidity requirements, cash flow projections for the groupings of the different funds, procedures for selecting and dismissing investment managers when utilized, and indices or benchmarks against which returns will be measured. And it kind of goes on from there. But ultimately, in large part, it's a delegation with very general guidelines. And then it's going to be important. I mean, we may do that, but ultimately that's the idea, is that as we come off here, these common pooled funds are going to be various groupings. There are certain things. LISRA has one type of grouping. Obviously, the construction funds for state schools are probably a different type of a grouping. We've got this other general agency obligations which we've appropriated, which are in the pooled fund. Those may be a different type of a grouping, but it requires, and we're going to want, to have the very similar analysis that we have there. We're going to want, you know, how do we establish that? What are the requirements? What should be invested in? How much? We can set limits. But that's the conversation, I think, that we have after it's passed, to come back and, again, figure out what we and how we would modify the existing statutes with respect to the direction we give to the Board of Investments about how they do and what they have to do and what they have to report back to us with respect to how these funds would be invested and the implementation of the
of this amendment carried out.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate Joint Resolution 2, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Senate Joint Resolution 2 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Our next Senate file for consideration is Senate File 12. Will the reading clerk please read the file?
Senate File 12, Trespassing to Collect Data, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinsky, Vaught, Flatter, and Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 12. There are standing committee amendments. I'd ask that the reading clerk read in the amendment.
Senate File 12, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 1.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move the amendment. And to further discuss the bill and amendments, I'd ask you to call on Senator Hicks.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the body, before I dive into the bill, what I would like to give you a little background is why the need and the purpose for this bill to begin with. If we go into our existing criminal trespass statutes, let me explain to you how that operates. So you have some entity, some person that for nefarious and malicious intent is trespassing on your property to collect information or data that then they intend to reposit this data in some place that is going to result in adverse impacts to either you, your property, or your business. Under the current law, the way that works is the only thing you can do as a landowner or property owner is ask that person to leave. And if they leave, there is no criminal act. Well, what happens to the information that they collected that then goes into some depository of some agency that then subjects you to additional scrutiny, additional regulatory takings, delays your ability to make a living, precludes you from implementing practices that are vital to your business? There's nothing. That's the current situation that exists today under our criminal trespass code. So, what this law attempts, this new bill, which would carve out a new penalty, as 63414, is trespassing to unlawfully collect resources and collect resource data, tries to get to this issue of not trespassing for the purpose of taking pictures of flowers or hunting or inadvertently crossing somebody's property to go fishing. Get to those trespassers that are doing this for malicious and nefarious intent to collect data. Let me walk you through the bill, Mr. Chairman, members, and then what I'd like to do is get back to the amendment. So what this does is it carves out a new criminal statute that says if you enter or cross this private land for the purpose of collecting data and you do not have, these are the provisions that would exempt you from this statutory, contractual, or other legalized authorization to enter across the land to collect resource data, that you would have to have written or verbal permission of the owner, the lessee, the agent, or the owner to enter across the land to collect the specific data. A person is guilty of unlawfully collecting resource data if he enters into, crosses, or crosses private open land and collects resource data without those legally protections that you have statutory, contractual, or other legal authorization. Here's another provision if we go to page 3 and you go to section C, trespassing to unlawfully collect resource data and unlawfully collecting resource data are punishable. Because this is a different type of trespass than those inadvertent trespass, this is done for malicious and nefarious intent. So we changed the penalties associated with this. First offense would be by imprisonment of not more than 6 months and a fine of not more than $5,000. And to really curtail this activity, the second offense is by imprisonment of not less than 10 days, not more than 1 year, and a fine of $5,000 or both. I'm not going to go through the definitions, members of the body. If there's questions on those, you can read those. I do think it is worth pointing out the one definition of what would constitute criminal trespass for data. The one definition that I want to focus on is on page 2, Romanet number 3. Resource data means data related to land or land use, including but not limited to data regarding agriculture, minerals, geology, history, cultural artifacts, archaeology, air, water, soil, conservation, habitat, vegetation, or animal species. Those are the arenas that if you were collecting data and you didn't have permission to do that, that you would fall under this statute. With that, if we turn to the next page of the bill, Mr. Chairman, we do also exempt out law enforcement officers and the official performance of their duty. The next section, subsection E, that says no data collected in violation of this section is admissible in evidence in a civil, criminal, or administrative procedure other than a prosecution of the violation. Subsection F is a vitally important component to this that you don't see in the existing criminal trespass. This brings into the issue of what do you do with the data once it's been collected. Subsection F, resource data collected in violation of this section in possession of any governmental entity as defined in WS 139-103 shall be expunged from the entity and all files of the databases. The reason this is important, if this was collected based on a criminal activity, you sure don't want this residing in the databases of some state agency that then results in the potential impacts of the data that was collected. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to walk through the amendment now. Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 7. If we go to page 2, line 1, you delete the word "for." Page 2, line 2, insert "for purposes of collecting." I believe the chairman already moved the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman. So if we take that amendment, what that effectively does to subsection little I, as it currently reads, it says enters onto or crosses private land for the purpose of collecting resource data. This changes it to collecting data. This is a substantive change to the draft from a standpoint. Under the current scenario, you have to prove intent, that somebody was intending to go on and cross that property to collect data. This changes it to they've actually in the process of committing the crime. They've collected the data. The next amendment, if we go to page 2, line 10, strikes the word "verbal," so it will now need that you have to have written permission. And this is pretty important from a standpoint of potential prosecution. There's very few people that are going to try to prosecute a violation of a verbal contract. This is a contract. This is giving somebody the permission to go on and inventory your property and inventory those resources. And because there is potential criminal implications associated with this bill, it tightens it up that you have to have that written contractual obligation to collect that data versus just a verbal "he said, she said" type scenario. So I think that's a substantive change. I think it actually strengthens the bill and the intent of the bill. The next amendment, Mr. Chairman, is just a cleanup amendment, takes it and consolidates one sentence into two sentences. So it's not a substantive change. It's more just a grammatical change. You see that same change on page 3, line 3. The next substantive amendment is on page 5, line 16. If you go to that section on Romanet number 3, it inserts, Mr. Chairman, that subsection F on page 5, it inserts at the end of that, nor shall it be considered in determining any agency action. Basically, that says is if this data was illegally collected, first, once it's been prosecuted, it has to be expunged from any agency database files. And furthermore, can't be used for an agency determination or a decision based on illegally collected data. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for questions on the amendment. No questions, I'd ask for the body's favorable consideration of a yes vote.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, rise on and against the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, I was concerned about this bill as introduced, and the Standing Committee has just changed my concern, if this amendment is adopted, from concern to strong opposition to the bill. And let me explain a little bit about where I'm coming from. And as you all know, I'm a landowner, and I have concerns about trespass. I want to be able to protect myself against it. But I'm also involved, Mr. Chairman, in the National Audubon Society's Christmas Bird Count effort, which provides a very large and very extensively used database on a number of bird-related issues. I've been the compiler for the Bates Hole Christmas Bird Count, which we make a big effort to take because it is providing information that will help defeat the efforts of the extremists to list the sage grouse, because we're in an area where the sage grouse is really doing quite well, thank you. And this bill, with this amendment, would make that census very difficult to legally take. The particular piece in the amendment I especially object to is the elimination of the verbal permission. When I go ask my neighbors for permission, I don't. Frankly, I don't have the time on chasing them all down and getting a written document for the annual bird count they've seen every year since 1978. We got better things to do with our time. It would be a major obstacle to that particular volunteer effort. It would, and that would destroy some of the very valuable information we're collecting to counter the assault by the various interest groups that want to suppress our agriculture and minerals industries by using the sage grouse as a vehicle. And so I have troubles with that part of the amendment, and then I have troubles with the rest of the bill, because I will tell you that I know I violated some of these provisions in the city of Casper on the Saturday before Christmas last. I collected some data walking up to a guy's front door to ask his permission to take a closer look at what looked like a hawk or an owl. And he wasn't there, but in the process of walking up there, I collected the data I needed. Knocked on his front door, nobody home. Couldn't get permission. I can't go to the whole city and ask for permission ahead of time on a thing like that. Doesn't work. But that's, Mr. Chairman, when we get in the bill, that's my concern. But my concern with this amendment is the removal of the verbal permission, which is the way we normally do business out in the country.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, and if we could, if I could dispense these points as they come up, it would help me to better articulate. But I would like to start with the good senator to my left's concerns about collecting the data in the city limits. So if you go to the provision on page 2, little I, it says, enter onto or crosses private open land. There is a definition for private open land in here. Open land means outside the exterior boundaries of any incorporated city, town, subdivision approved pursuant to WS 185301 or development approved pursuant to that act. So I think it addresses the issue of going into the city. This only covers open land. Those open lands are defined in this as being the exterior to those boundaries. So I think that addresses that. Collecting data to be able to hold back certain organizations. I would tell you that's exactly what this bill is designed to do. So you need to ask yourself, what's more important? The collective? Do we protect people or do we protect people's private property rights? The collective that the good senator to my left is referring to is the collective body is, I'm not sure who, the people, the state, protect their interests. This bill doesn't contemplate that. This bill means collecting that data that now goes into a database. Let's use the example that was thrown out here. Sage grouse. Less than a year from now, the United States government's going to make a determination of whether that's an endangered species. Let's talk about the ramifications of that. So somebody goes onto your property and they collect information on how big the lek is, not only the lek, under the Endangered Species Act, a take of habitat is considered a take of the species. So they go out there and they say, you have 10,000 acres of suitable habitat on your private property. And we've mapped all this. We know that there's 5 leks with over 126 birds on there. That now goes into the federal database. The decision to list is the bird gets listed. What we've effectively done now is say, look, you put that landowner in jeopardy of coming in and having all of his property designated as critical habitat. If he goes out and conducts normal farming and ranching operations of brush control, stockwater development, the federal government can now come in and say, you can't use your property for that purposes anymore. That's the very purpose for what this bill is designed to do. So we can either worry about the collective philosophy as trying to beat somebody back, or we can worry about those private property rights. Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for a do adopt consideration on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, on and against the amendment, and the reason is just to expand and a little bit from my fellow senator from Natrona County. I mean, when we talk about verbal, the biggest problem I have with the amendment, Your Honor, Mr. Chairman, is the verbal part. Ultimately, you're telling the landowner that now he can't give verbal permission; he has to give written permission. I mean, my experience with landowners whether I'm hunting or whether I'm out fishing or whatever it is. I get verbal permission. Very rarely do I ever get written permission. And so we recognize in our law the enforcement of verbal contracts throughout that. And to simply limit this now to where you're actually forbidding a landowner from giving verbal permission just is one of those things that probably infringes a little bit too far and I think just doesn't recognize the existence of the viability and enforceability of verbal agreements among individuals.
A new voice, Senator Kinski. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Speaking for the amendment, I would point out that this bill has been under a substantial period of consideration, and we do permit those who have statutory authorization, so government employees, we heard from a number of government employees, contractual authorization, that addresses the concerns of oil and gas and mineral interests. They have contractual authorization to enter. Other legal authorization. And we did have verbal in there for the longest time on the understanding that that's how Wyoming works. But as we went through the discussion, we came to realize that we weren't necessarily talking about entry for a day to fish or hunt, but we were talking about entry possibly for purposes of data collection. We heard from the conservation districts. They have written agreements, written permission forms they've developed with all of the folks that they work with. We heard with other agencies that have or are developing or are willing to develop simple written agreements, because the problem was, as the discussion advanced in the interim committee, is the problem of proof. If you're trying to pursue a trespass allegation against a particular group, an extremist or advocacy group, you have problems of proof. And so the written authorization, in relation to data collection, not in relation to hunting or fishing, was where the committee finally came down. This was adopted by the committee as an amendment, that it would eliminate the problems of proof in these particular cases. So with that, I would urge adoption of the amendments as presented.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to clarify this. This doesn't change the culture of Wyoming. You can go get verbal permission to picnic, camp, hunt, run, chase your dog, ride your bicycle. It doesn't change that. You still can do that verbal permission of a landowner. This only requires written permission. If you want to go onto that property and collect resource data, information, doesn't change all the rest of getting verbal information. So it's very specific as to when you would require written approval. That's a contractual agreement that you're going to go collect information. This isn't for your own personal use. So I just want to make that clarification, Mr. Chairman. It doesn't expand it into all these other arenas.
Question has been on the amendment, Senator Christensen. Senator.
Mr. Chairman, on the amendment, the question that arises about verbal versus written, I just draw the body's attention to the incident that really brought this on. It was not Wyoming people that stood up and talked about the Code of the West. And so we're trying to apply our own standards, and the organization that began this most recent attack on property rights, that wasn't the way they conducted their business. So I just urge us to think about adopting this amendment, being cautious about trying to apply our good nature and the Code of the West to a group of people that don't necessarily see it the same way.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 12, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The amendment's passed. Back on the bill. Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not to belabor, and I know we're getting late in the hour, but I do have some confusion over this bill, and maybe I'm the only one. We have a situation up in my neck of the woods under which we face some pretty stiff penalties from the EPA, and frankly, if we don't do the work of correcting what's going on in that North Platte drainage, my community stands to lose substantial amounts of money. In fact, we're faced with some real financial hardship. The state of Wyoming, quite frankly, is faced with some hardship if we don't get that river cleaned up. So what's going on there with our conservation folks is that it's paramount to them that they get out on these properties and do some testing. I just want to make sure that there isn't that unintended consequence here, that our conservation district can't go out and do the work that is absolutely critical to the state of Wyoming all the way down that Platte River. The other piece that I just want to make sure that we're not stepping in here is the ability of college classes or high school classes or people to go out there and do some GIS study or to just simply do some educational activity out on land. That's my only concern, and maybe the sponsor could help me with those two areas. I just want to make sure we're not closing the gate and putting a padlock on it.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. If I may, before the sponsor rises, and I realize this committee the whole, but I just would give him another question so he can stand at one time. I, too, live along the river, and there's a lot of aerial activity. There's a lot of boats and whatnot, but a lot of airplane traffic, wildlife counts, bird identification and that. We live in an era of drones. My question is, was there conversation in regard to not so much putting your foot on somebody else's property, but flying over in an aerial fashion, be it drone or whatever, in order to in the collection of data, and how that fits then into this conversation we're now having?
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I've got two concerns with the bill. While I understand the issue with respect to prohibiting folks from coming onto your property to gather data, notwithstanding that, when I take a step back, I see at least two constitutional issues with respect to this bill. The first is pointed out, if you take a look at on page 4, open land means land outside the exterior boundaries of any city, et cetera. So what we've done in doing this bill is we're classifying private land that's inside the city and private land that resides outside. And our courts have made it pretty clear that when you examine Article 1, Section 34, that bills ought to be of uniform application operation throughout the state. And Article 3, Section 27 prohibits special legislation. Special legislation does occur. We have a body of law that says it occurs where you begin to create classes where you differentiate between cities and counties. So that in all fairness, when you begin to say, well, I want to craft this bill so I don't want to have to deal with anything for you folks that live in town, much of these issues would be the same as true in your town. If you're living in town, you don't want people coming through your property gathering data while you're gone. In fact, if you could keep the meter readers out, you'd probably love that as well. But regardless, this is a separate class. The separate is you begin to describe things as open land, and again, you're creating a new classification of lands where if you've got things that are not open, that are different than open, notwithstanding it's all private land. So I'd be curious whether the sponsor has considered those issues and undertaken those analyses to determine whether or not this is a constitutional classification of private property into different groups.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I guess I look at it and standpoint that you'd almost have to because you have cities and towns have home rule. And necessarily the state is not supposed to do a lot of things within the cities and county boundaries that they take care of that law themselves. So I'm not sure whether or not, you know, you may have an argument that it's a special bill, two subs or whatever, but on the other hand, I think you've got the home rule question, and if you included them, you may have another argument that has at least as much legs to stand on. So,
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In looking at that, I think there's that issue. I mean, we do that, obviously. Keep in mind, this is a criminal statute. And so we have, we oftentimes have statutes that apply, but doesn't prevent a city or a county from having their own, or particularly a city or a town from having their own ordinances and potential criminal violations of, of ordinances oftentimes are the same as those outside the land. The other thing, where this bill is right now, I think the other is just is a vagueness issue with respect to constitutionality. When you look at page 3, lines 9 through the bottom of 4 and over the top of 5, where you're talking about resource data, the definition of resource data means any data relating to land or its use, including but not limited to data regarding agriculture, minerals, geology, history, agricultural artifacts, archaeology, air, water, soil, conservation, habitat, vegetation, or animal species. Mr. Chairman, when you look at that, as I'm taking a fish, taking a picture of an outcropping or an animal, or a geological outcropping, taking a cultural or historical artifact in the context of schools or other things, if you're on there with verbal permission to do that, and ultimately you take a picture of the animal that you shoot on somebody's property, and you've got a geological outcropping in the background again, those are now, it seems to me that in this, you're starting to get in this area where you can be charged with these things. While nevertheless your purpose may not have been there, we've now changed it with the, as it's been amended now, it's not even for the purpose of collecting data, it's just collecting data. And so making an annotation in a field book, taking a photograph, any of those things are potentially collecting data, and now so I think ultimately you have to give, particularly in the context of a criminal statute, you have to give fair warning to individuals about exactly what is the prohibited behavior. And I think that where this is now and with the amendment we've done, we've gotten to the point that this may be, I think, certainly, I don't know if you'd prevail or not, but certainly you could challenge it just for its void for vagueness.
Mr. Minority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One other concern that I have that hasn't been voiced yet is the concept of whether you're knowingly trespassing or simply trespassing. So we've got the field trip of students, and they're taking pictures of flowers, and they have no idea that, as it turns out, they're trespassing. And there's no knowingly aspect. All you have to do is be trespassing and collect data. So that intent isn't there. So that, you know, the whole school group taking pictures of the flowers is now apparently subject to imprisonment for not more than 6 months or up to a fine of $5,000 or both. There really isn't any possibility for someone to simply make an error in this piece of legislation. So I'd ask the sponsors if they'd be willing to add language that at least implies that you have to knowingly be trespassing instead of simply happen to be out of place.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, a few comments on previous comments that have come up and how we lay on this. As far as trespassing goes, if you're taking a picture off the road, this isn't a problem. You can do it, anything you can see off the road. What this says is you get on somebody's place, and you either cross it or you're on it intentionally. And I think the amendment would be in order potentially on the intentional end of it. But as a rancher, I can tell you, my ranch is my house. It's no different than in town. And you rather expect that when someone's there, that they're there with your permission. And you know, I think this bill's very, very appropriate. I think the written part's there. There's no problem if you don't have a problem with it. Back to the verbal. If you gave verbal to somebody and it's actually somebody you trust, my guess is they're going to get signed and it's not a problem. Where it's a problem is when somebody comes on and they infer that they had some type of verbal permission. And, you know, to me, the data collection is exactly that. I happen to live next to a national monument, and they consistently like to have people to find reasons to wander around my place. I'm happy to have them do it. We let them bike. We let them do a lot of neat stuff. But we make it pretty clear that we're not very open to them to go out on little search missions. And this happens all the time. And I think this bill is very necessary. If someone's going to come on you and look for something good or bad that can have unintended consequences on your operation, it's your right to say, I'd like to know what's there. And we do it all the time. If you're looking for a Native American site on my place, I want the university to come back to me and tell me what's there. And it's up to me to decide if I want to disclose it. That's the kind of thing I think that this is very important. You don't want someone that's out there that causes unintended consequences. This bill's a good one. It makes sense. and it actually really works. Back to your bird surveys, you don't have a problem. If you're heading out on somebody's place, if you know you got the permission, you're going to say it was no big deal. But if it's somebody there for evil purposes, you just assume that you gave them permission to be there. Then it's your fault if you screwed it up.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on and against the bill, I was convinced earlier that, yeah, it's worded so you won't get in trouble in town, and we heard that may have its own legal problems. But let me give you a scenario. Somebody taking a bird census, and the ranch house is located at some distance off the public road. You drive down the guy's driveway to go ask permission. On the way there, it's eagle habitat. You see a golden eagle, you've counted him. Or you don't see a golden eagle, so that is, there wasn't one. You've collected data either way. You get to his house, and probably the absence of the bird is more important data in some ways than the presence of it. But you get to his house, and you ask permission. If the way this bill is written, if the owner says yes when you ask, you're fine. You'd have to have a form so he'd give you the written permission, I suppose. But if he says yes, you're fine. If he says no, you committed a criminal offense without knowing you were going to commit a criminal offense. So the way this bill is written, you can get in jail for the simple act of going down and asking for permission. And that's not something we ought to put in statute.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, on and for the bill. You know, we're starting to do a fair amount of what-if-ing on this, and I know that's always important. But the example we're talking about here, let's bring it back to a property rights issue. And testimony we heard in committee, opposition to this bill, was framed in a fashion that said, with a bill like this, how are investigative reporters supposed to wander around your place and look in your buildings? This is a property rights issue. We're starting to stray into good neighbors and treating each other well. It's down to just simple property rights.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, if I can walk through at least some of the questions that I have answers to, and at least one that I'll find before tomorrow as this bill moves on. First question for my more vertically challenged senator from Natrona County was what happens to the conservation district if they want to go out and collect water quality? Simple fact is those conservation districts that are very active in this room have been provided a template from the Attorney General's office for a written agreement. The Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality will no longer accept any data collected by not only conservation districts but any third party unless they have a written agreement. And they can not only have a written agreement, but they can also show the route in which they traveled to get to that point, because there has been such egregious abuse of this collecting these water quality data by third parties around the state of Wyoming. We've had to go to extraordinary measures to protect private property rights. Education. The question come up is, well, now if the school's down there and they're doing an education, it doesn't contemplate education. It says if you're collecting resource data, you can go out there and teach kids about water quality samples and look at bugs and trees and identify grass. That's an educational opportunity. They're not out there for nefarious purposes to collect data that's going to then reside in a database someplace. So it's not covered and it's not contemplated as far as this would regulate some kind of educational activity on a private landowner's property. The other question from the good senator from Converse County was, what about aerial drones and It did come up in discussion, and it expanded beyond just the physical trespass on land into an area. You get into the Federal Aviation Authority and HAL FLY and federal drones and all this. This doesn't contemplate that. Strictly the physical trespass on the ground. Boating. Boating is an authorized activity under the state of Wyoming. As long as you're floating and not physically standing on that property, it's considered a public right-of-way. It's no different than driving down the highway and taking a picture or something. Again, you wouldn't be captured under this law if you're boating through somebody's property. On the issue of a separate class of land, I'll have to get back to you on that one. On the question of inserting something knowingly, it becomes an extremely difficult bar to prove. It was brought up by the good senator from the Ivory Towers. There was quite a bit of discussion on this, and it was left with the committee's opinion, and I think the majority of the folks, that this should be a strict liability. It is your liability. If you're out there to go out there to collect information on somebody's private property, that liability is getting that written agreement certainly resides with that person that's going to collect that data. The liability doesn't roll with the landowner that says, well, you know, I have to prove that you were knowingly out there collecting that. It's strict liability on you, the collector of that data. So, Mr. Chairman, I think I went through all those questions. I will, before the second reading, try to get to the answer to this issue of the constitutionality of creating a separate class of land. Members of the body, I do think this is an important piece of legislation. I think there'll be opportunities as we move forward with this to further this discussion in the second and third reading and perhaps bring some other amendments. With that, I would ask for your favorable consideration of Senate File 12.
Are you ready for the question? Senator Burns.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, but it's about the third, fourth time I've stood to try and be recognized for my question. And it is just a question about this legislation and the application of it. What if the criminal penalty retroactive? If the trespasser is not caught actually standing on the property, but you see that as some filing or report that could only have been taken because of trespassing, does that filing or photograph serve as evidence that they actually committed the crime? And so would that, in fact, I guess that's my question. Do they have to be caught red-handed doing the collecting, or can that serve as evidence later to be prosecuted?
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, not being a great legal scholar on the issue, but I believe the answer is if you can prove that that data was collected, and it can only be collected through a trespass, in fact, you could be captured under that law, under this law. That's my understanding. But you would have to be able to go and prove in a court of law that you have irrefutable evidence that the only way this data could be collected is if there was a trespass.
Question's been called for. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 12, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Senate File 12 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Division. A division has been called. All those in favor of Senate File 12, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. You may sit down. Ellen, 13 noes, 14 yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. 15. I vote yes. Mr. Majority Floor, yes.
If the bill is passed or would have failed on a tie vote would be appropriate.
The bill has passed.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
I move the committee of the whole riding report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried.
The reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. President, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate file 31, do pass. Senate file 44, do pass. Senate file 30, do pass. Senate file 5, do pass. Senate file 25, do pass, amended. Senate file 34, do pass, amended. Senate joint resolution 2, do pass. And Senate file 12, do pass, amended. Senator Emmerich, chairman.
Senator Emmerich.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the committee of the whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion is carried. The report has been adopted. Do you have anything else to do? Committee report. We have...
January the 19th, 2015, Mr. President, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 14, Asset Forfeiture 2, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Hicks, Kinski. No, Senator Esquivel, Von Flader, and Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Does that clear the desk? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that we stand recessed until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Could be. Announcements. Senator Guy.
Mr. President, Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, and Land Resources, will meet tomorrow night upon adjournment, and we're going to take up Senate File 51, Water Development Amendments, Senate File 55, Omnibus Water Bill Planning, and Senate File 4, Dry Bean Research.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, advance notice on Wednesday on adjournment of both houses. Your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet in room 302 to hear the director of the Department of Health on Senate File 66, Medicaid Expansion, and on the related share plan proposal. And we aren't going to take any more public testimony at that meeting, but we intend to hear from the department director and give him wide latitude to conduct the meeting so he can make his pitch, and we'll ask him questions as to how this particular legislation would work and how he feels about it. It'll be a committee meeting technically, but all the members of the Senate, and we're going to invite House members as well, are welcome to attend and hear that. So it'll be on adjournment of both houses on Wednesday.
And then if the chairman would please, that have committees on Wednesday afternoon, if you could postpone or reschedule, we'd ask you consider that so your members can attend that. That's a pretty important issue this year, and I think we want to at least provide the opportunity for members to hear directly from the department with respect to the share plan and the alternate plan. So chairman with meetings on Wednesday are asked to take that into consideration in their schedule. Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your travel committee number 6 will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room S14 to consider Senate File 69, non-resident allocation of game licenses.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the Joint Appropriations Committee will continue its work tomorrow at 8 a.m. in room 204 to begin the consideration of governor's letters. And then, Mr. President, your Senate Appropriations Committee will also meet upon noon recess in room S11 to consider the following bills. Senate File 8, State Education Accountability and Assessment. Senate File 26, Challenge Loan Interest Rate. And Senate File 57, School Facilities Appropriations.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, Committee Number 8, Transportation, will meet in S14 in about 5 minutes for Senate File 29, Senate File 27, and Senate File 71.
Are there any other announcements? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 3, Revenue, decided it was time to go to work, Mr. President, so we are meeting tomorrow. This is Tuesday, January 20th, 30 minutes after noon recess, to consider Senate File 42, Task Force on Mental Taxes, Senate File 82, Funeral Services Practitioners Act Amendments.
Is that all the announcements? You've heard the majority floor leader's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate staff stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Tuesday, January 20th.